Well, I ain't so sure what we're gonna do today. My horror, of course, is the idea that I talk like other professors. Surely that's not the case. Tell me that's not the case. We have a little housekeeping business to attend to today. I have the first set of papers to give back to a handful of you who wrote on this topic. I'll do that in just a second. But let me make a couple of points to you about these writing assignments. First, I don't want you to rely on me to give you the assignment if you're absent from class. Partly that's simply a practical matter. That is, I only check my email about every third day because I forget I have it. So you're much more than likely to get no answer from me out of sheer inadvertence. But also, I don't want to do that, even by choice. So what I suggest is that you think summer camp. Did you all go to summer camp? You get a buddy. You know, you look out for each other so that if you're drowning, you have a buddy there to say, hey, he's drowning. So if you miss class and want to find out if there was a writing assignment, then I suggest you not email me, much less call me, but email your buddy. Maybe that Nick, where did Nick go? He may be soft-hearted and answer for you, but I'm not going to. So that's my suggestion to you. Find someone in the class we'll do that for you. Now, secondly, I'm about to take up the writing assignments that you did last time. But let me remind you, if you have elevated this writing assignment to be one of your formal ones that you want it graded, again, designate that with a big W at the top, which stands for writing, or woe is me, or will this never end, or whatever. Some W though, so that people know that's your paper. Let me then hand back this first set. Nick, did you want to say anything about these?
No, they look good so far. Don't be afraid to use I. And
students are, though, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I remember being taught that somewhere.
I was, too, and I think it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, go ahead and use the first person. And you can assume that your reader has is familiar with the text. I mean, again, with the three-page response, there's no real need to get too expositional with your explanations about plot or you know, sort of the action, the narrative action of the story. So you can just assume straight off the bat that your reader has read the text, and yeah, it's
knows who the characters are. Yeah, just assume you have a knowledgeable reader, so that you don't have to tell the story. We don't want plot summary or a thumbnail description of who the characters are. Assume that's all done and get under the problem. Okay? Hong Shin Pan? Amy Chatham? Margaret Hope Allen? Lisa Hoffman? And Caroline Godfrey. Don't remember that. You see the story on the news, there's some professor, I think, over at the Macomb Community College. And he was getting in all sorts of trouble for using such profane language, English professor, of course, using such profane language, so I'm tempted to do that today, just riddle my speech with, you know, all of this profanity and see if they give us an x-ray. Okay, I had asked you to give me your opinion today on a particular topic having to do with Christopher Newman's disposition of the letter that comes into his possession from the old marquee, and I want to take those up now. But I also wanted to pose one fact question for you to answer. I gave you factoid on the same sheet. It's this. When Christopher Newman last sees Noemi Neosh in London, with whom is she walking? Christopher Newman last sees Noemi Neosh in London. With whom is she walking? Okay, we'll pass those up. Oh, I should say, I think I've said this before, but let me say again. If you're here and haven't done the writing assignment, but just want to get credit simply for attending, and if you do get some, just give me a piece of paper with your name on it, if nothing else. That will say, you're here. You may not have done the work in advance, but you're here. Okay, do I have some? That's it. Take what's yours. Last time, I tried to suggest to you the agenda that, very conscious agenda, that Henry James had in writing The American, that in the preface that he wrote about almost 35 years later, he's remembering the origins of this novel, how the idea came to him, what he wanted to do in it. And if you recall that, he said that he wanted to create a situation in which an American, in some ways a typical American, going to Europe is dealt some grievous injustice by a society that thinks itself superior to him in every way, and that the occasion would arise for him to be able to exact some kind of retribution or revenge for that injustice. And the question that fascinated James was, what would he do in that case? So we get to that situation today when we'll come in a bit to talk about the letter that he has that would inflict some significant damage, presumably, on the Bellegardes, and his decision not to do it, not to use it in that way. But with that in mind, the part of the novel that I had you read for the first day, that's a lot, over 300 pages, in some ways really doesn't develop that particular complexity very much. The wrong that is done to Christopher Newman. That comes only in chapter 18. And even then, in one sense, we wonder, is this a grievous wrong? I mean, I guess, of course, in a way it is, when her family forces Claire to break off her engagement to him. But in that chapter, when Newman goes to the Bellegarde's home, that after the night at the opera, where Valentine becomes embroiled in the situation that will lead to the duel and his death. When Newman enters the house, their house the next time, it says on page 312, he felt as soon as he entered the room that he was in the presence of something evil. Now, there are a lot of reasons not to like the Bellegardes. They're snobbish, they're hidebound, they're on a high horse, and all this. But just the night, a few nights before, Newman was teasing the old Marquise at the ball. He was in such a good mood, and he was sort of joshing with her and joking with her and all this sort of thing. Needling her. And she obviously didn't like this. But the relationship between them is not one where he felt that there was something evil. What accounts, in effect, for the shift from a comedy of manners? What I suggested to you last time is that the first part of The American is really a comedy of manners, where you just have two cultures clashing. The brash, frank, spontaneous, open-hearted, good-natured, rather ignorant American, Christopher Newman. I mean, even that name is so symbolic, isn't it? Newman, Christopher, the founder of the discoverer of the New World, at least in the old history. So you have this this figure on the one hand, and you have the bell guards on the other, the upholders of tradition and form and protocol and all sort of the aristocratic prerogatives. And the clash between these two is not really a moral one. There's no right or wrong here, so much as there are simply the ways that two different cultures behave and the clash that occurs when a figure from one of these cultures tries to insinuate himself into the milieu of one of the others. And so there's a certain degree of sort of comic misadventure going on here that in its own way is more amusing than anything else. Suddenly then, in this next chapter, Newman felt he was in the presence of something evil. So that at this point the novel turns from being novelistic to being what James himself later identifies as, we're talking genre now, a romance. I said some of this to you last time, but let me repeat it very briefly. The novel deals with the true to life, the ordinary, the everyday, and in a great degree, the criterion for judging a novel is verisimilitude, trueness to life. Does that represent life as we live it, as we experience? Does it seem to us then true? This is not the criterion of the romance. The romance, by its very nature, deals with the extraordinary, often with the supernatural, if not that, maybe with the preternatural, so that you get extreme situations. And things happen in romances that don't happen in everyday life. I remember when certain critics were objecting about that movie, Pocahontas, did you see that? That it wasn't historically accurate. And Mel Gibson said, for God's sake, there's a raccoon in it that talks. Of course it's not historically accurate. So, you know, in other words, you don't expect historical accuracy of a work that never claims to be a work of history. But it is instead a kind of fantasy. So that romance certainly shades into fantasy or to the extraordinary, the extreme, the preternatural, something like that. And so we suddenly move from being in the world of the novel, where we have this comic clash of manners, to a world of romance in the literary sense. This has nothing to do with kissy-kissy. To the strange, the ominous. Inexplicable. So how is James going to make the bell guards seem not just stuffy, not just arrogant, but evil? And in what way then does that impact on Christopher Newman? After all, I think James later in his career would have been perfectly able and willing to have made a novel out of nothing more than they're forcing Claire to break off the engagement. You can get great literature out of families getting in the way of love, you know, Roman and Juliet, all that sort of thing. And I think James would have done that. Here, however, he complicates it by wanting to make this, in a sense, really a kind of melodrama of good and evil. And the bell guards did, in some way, have to be transmogrified. That's a big word. I recorded today. Have to be transmogrified into something far more sinister than simply arrogant aristocrats who say to Newman, we made her break it off, says the Marquise. I could not, in the last analysis, reconcile myself to a commercial person. Now, you know, okay, that might be, how would you say, unfair. It might be arrogant. It might even be in bad faith. They had, after all, made a bargain of sorts with Newman, and they're now acting in bad faith. All that may be true, but it's a long way from that to saying, felt I was in the presence of something evil, and that the reader is supposed to share, I think, that feeling, that there's something very dark and sinister going on in the house of Bellegarde. And indeed, on his dying bed, Valentine divulges that there's some great dark family secret, and that there's a letter that contains all of this, and if Newman could only come into the possession of that letter. Well, okay, if Newman could come into the possession of that letter, what? Early on, after they forced Claire to break off the engagement, which she does, she enters a convent. That's almost right out of romance right there, isn't it? You have an unhappy little thing, you go to a convent. That happens all the time in medieval romance. So, what use will this letter be to Christopher, even if he has it? It won't get Claire back for him, because she's now, for a very different reason, unreachable. Will it give him simply the satisfaction of revenge? He says to Mrs. Brand, on page 375, I want to bring them down, down, down. I want to turn the tables upon them. I want to mortify them as they mortified me. Notice Claire's out of the picture now. This is not going to get Claire back. They took me up into a high place, and they made me stand there for all the world to see me, and then they stole behind me and pushed me into this bottomless pit where I lie howling and gnashing my teeth. I made a fool of myself before their friends, but I shall make something worse of them. Or he says to the Marquise herself on page 414, when he's presenting them with the evidence that he has of the murder, and that he will be able to use it against them. But again, it's not clear to what end. There's nothing practical or instrumental that he can achieve by this. As I say, won't get Claire back. About halfway down the page. No, he says, I want to say a few words more. I want to say that I hope you quite understand what I am about. This is my revenge, you know. You have treated me before the world, convened for the express purpose, as if I were not good enough for you. I mean to show the world that however bad I may be, you are not quite the people to say it. So, is this then in some ways a kind of status battle? They acted so high and mighty. They mortified me in front of the whole world, made a fool of me. Well, two can play at that game, and I think I have a trump for their ace that I'm planning to play to show the world what they're like. So that's the initial motive for his wanting to find this letter, and his stratagem for planning to use it. And we'll come into a minute, to the question in a minute of why doesn't he? But let me take up one other matter for just a moment. One of the difficulties of this novel, from almost every critic that I presumed from a lot of you ordinary readers, what Virginia Woolf calls the common reader, and she means well by that, she admires the common reader, is that the figure of Claire is very nebulous, very indistinct in this novel. She doesn't emerge very vividly in her own right. And all sorts of questions arise about Claire's motivation. Is she really in love with Newman? Does she have none of her family's aristocratic distaste for his commercial background and origins? If they're so appalled by this that he once made washtubs, why not Claire? why is she so willing to accept him when everyone else finds this? Even Valentine, you remember when Christopher first broaches the subject with him, even Valentine, who's his friend, is shocked by the idea, you can't marry my sister. It would be unheard of. So why is Claire so pliable in this? Why is she so accepting? Is it some enormous charm that he has? Is it a real love? Is she simply wanting to get away from that wretched mother? You could certainly understand that. Does there seem to be any real spark between, or chemistry between them? If we were reviewing this as a movie, what Roger's saying, there's no real chemistry between these two characters. And there may not be. And then if so, if there really is some deep affection, why does Claire so easily break off the engagement? Her mother says, I demanded that she do so, and she obeyed. Not much of an explanation. So that the whole figure of Claire in some way remains sort of vague and nebulous. And again, many years later, when James is writing his preface for the New York edition of The American, he perceives that weakness. But he tries in a certain way to make it into a virtue when he tells us what he was trying to do. Reading the prose of James at that later period is always a challenge. It's extremely difficult. But let me try a couple of sentences on you of what he was saying about Claire, and indeed all of the other characters in the novel except Newman. He was the lighted figure that is Newman. The others, even doubtless to an excessive degree, the woman who is made the agent of his discomfort, that is Claire, were to be obscured. Again, Newman is the lighted figure. If you think of this as a play, the spotlight's on Newman. The others, including Claire, he says, were to be obscured. By which I should largely get the very effect most to be invoked, that of a generous nature engaged with forces, with difficulties, and with dangers that it but half understands. The other characters have to be mysterious, obscure, their motives not apparent, because the perception of them that we have is only Newman's. He doesn't understand. He doesn't know what they're up to. He doesn't gauge the complexity of their motives and so forth. So James said, I had to leave those characters obscure to the reader because they were obscure to him. That is Newman again, he therefore supremely matters. The rest matters only as he feels it, treats it, meets it. To go into the background to that statement would take us too far afield, but what's happened by the time James comes to write the preface here is that literary modernism has begun to emerge. And often in that literary mode, the concentration is entirely on the single figure as it experiences the world, and therefore it becomes an exercise in subjectivity. Rather than writing the kind of sociological novel where you have a vast cast of characters and we can enter in the mind of any one of these characters at any time because we have an omniscient author, and therefore you can see, this is what this guy's thinking, that's what this girl's thinking, this is what this man's thinking, this is what his mother's thinking. The omniscient author allows us to enter into the mind of any character at any time, and so they're in some ways all equally imagined. If you think of a great novel like, say, Middlemarch, I think Eliot must have there 30 or so major characters, and at any moment she can tell us what this character's thinking, what his motives are, why he's doing what he's doing. But with modernism and the increase in subjectivity, we begin to get the world is experienced only through one sensibility. I suppose the most famous example of this is James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where Stephen Dedalus is the only reality in the novel. Everybody else exists only as Stephen perceives them. And when he quits thinking about them, for all practical purposes, they cease to exist. It's a very sort of solipsistic novel. That is, the only reality that things have are in the mind of the perceiver. And in that novel, his very obscure love, the woman Amarata, we don't even know her name. We know he has a girlfriend. We know her name is EC. We know her initials are EC because he writes a poem about it, you know, to EC. But we don't even know what her name is. So that she remains simply a floating, fleeting figment of Stephen's perception. So that modernism will come to elevate that mode to a particular aesthetic modus operandi, that the only character that you really have to give great reality in life to is the central consciousness, the figure who possesses that central consciousness. Now, as I say, James writes the preface 35 years after he writes the novel, and he wrote a novel in which you have a lot of not very well or not very believable characters. Certainly they don't have the richness and depth that we would expect from James's later characters. And so he's in some way trying to make a virtue out of that by saying, well, you have to understand the only character who really matters in this novel is Christopher Newman. What we want to see is a novel from his point of view, from his perspective. And he didn't understand these people. He didn't know what the depth and complexity of Claire's motives and personality were. Therefore, she remains, to some degree, an enigma in the novel, because she was an enigma to Christopher. And I suppose that there's some degree of legitimacy in that claim. I think, am I right about that? I don't think there's any scene in the novel that he's not in. We never have some scene where Claire is confiding in someone why she's engaged to. Of course, who would you confide to in that house? But you see the problem is that if Newman is in every scene, then there is never any sense of what's going on behind what he sees, what the intricacies are, and so forth, unless some other character tells him. But then you have to wonder what their motives are. Are they always telling the truth? So when you limit the novel, as James does here, to the experience and perceptions of a single character, then it means that the motives and inner lives of the other characters remain, to a great degree, a kind of closed book. Does that make sense to you? So there is a lot of reader dissatisfaction, I think, with how obscure and in some way unreal than the character of Claire is. Because, for example, Valentine is a much better developed character. James doesn't have to sacrifice the depth of character development, as you can see with that character, who comes much more to life, has much more reality to it than his sister does. But in a way, James is committed to keeping Claire as this kind of ideal, this treasure, this sort of almost unattainable item, the best item in the market, you see, which Newman is wanting to buy. To some degree, that may depend upon the distance from it. You see, if you get up close, and you begin to see, you know, maybe she has bad breath, you know, there may be a wart on her nose that he hadn't seen before. In other words, this idealization of Claire may, to some degree, depend upon her always remaining sort of this distant, idealized figure. But then we come to, I think, the even more difficult figure of the Marquise, her mother, who's a kind of comic figure early on in the novel. You know, appalled that her daughter might marry this, not only this American, but this American businessman, this savage, this boor. And certainly that scene where they're giving the great ball and Newman is pushing it for all it's worth, you know, making her walk around, meeting all of her friends, and, you know, she's chagrined by the whole thing. But all of that has a sort of comic side. And then suddenly we're told in this chapter, there's something evil in this house, something sinister. And indeed there is, because it turns out the Marquise, in addition to being a stuffed shirt, is a murderess. Now, where did that come from? Straight out of romance. The family's keeping this great dark secret that the Marquise had murdered her husband. But then again, if you start looking at it in detail, that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Why does she murder him? Why does she murder him? Because he opposes the marriage of their daughter to Comte de Cintré. Who the hell is the Comte de Cintré? Turns out he's a fraud. Has no money. Treats Claire badly. Besides, this family prides itself on being one of the most important, distinguished old families in France. There's no great gain that I can see by marrying Claire off to this guy, even if he were who they thought he was, which he isn't. So if anything, the Marquise comes off not only as a murderess, but kind of a dimwit, doesn't she? This is the best way you can arrange a marriage for your daughter, by killing your husband? And it really doesn't make a lot of sense. The whole thing is contrived and creepy. But what James is wanting to do here is find some great, terrible crime that the Bellegardes have been hiding all these years.
Mm-hmm. I thought the passage where Mrs. Brett is talking about the ribbon that she kept like all her life, I mean, I thought there must be something going on there.
Between the two of them?
Between the two of them. I mean, even if it wasn't officially
yeah.
consummated.
Wouldn't that be a motive for murder? In France, particularly. When President Mitterrand died at his graveside, where his wife and mistress sort of standing there holding hands, you know what I mean? They do these things differently in France. But I don't know. Mrs. Brett says the Marquise accused her of that, accused them of having something going on. But I'm British, she says. We don't do that. So I don't know. Again, I would think the later James would probably have taken up that sort of possibility, making this far more. But I think this is just some sheer melodrama that James is concocting here. I mean, writing this letter on your deathbed, I've been poisoned, you know, my wife is killing me, and writing this letter and secreting it to the servant. I mean, you know, the whole thing is out of bad opera, isn't it? And you know, as I say, James himself later came to feel this. When you can tell he's kind of embarrassed. When he writes this introduction all those years later, at the sort of clumsy creakiness of his plot in this part. It is George Sand. It's straight George Sand. As I told you, she used to write this kind of novel. They're immensely popular. They were sort of the Harlequin romances of their day. And so in some sense, you know, the gloomy castle and the family with the hidden secrets and murder being committed there and everybody knowing it but nobody mentioning it to the other. They carry around this great guilty secret all these years that now falls into Newman's hands. So I think, in other words, in order to get this transition from the comedy of manners to this melodrama, which is really about great moral questions, it involves a great leap on James's part from one kind of fiction to another, from one kind of world into another. We're now into this world, you know, dark, sinister forces that work in the House of Belgarde. And it just doesn't really convince, I think. This is the problem with the latter part of the novel. But he's doing all of this to bring us to that scene that I asked you to write about for today, that when Newman has in his possession this letter written by the Marquise as he's dying, and can exact a revenge for all of the indignity heaped on him, what do you do with it, and why? And in a very important way, this was James's initial idea. This is the germ of the novel. He wanted this great moment that when the American has been so terribly wronged, he says, dealt this grievous wrong, and has it in his power to pay back with interest. What does he do? And why does he do it? And is it the right thing to do? That's what I wanted you to opine on today.
Well, I thought that there was no choice, like, as far as his character goes, for him to do anything else but burn the letter. Because, like, he's so noble. Like, he's presented as such a noble figure that, like, even as I read the last few chapters, I'm like, yeah, right, he's not going to use the letter.
Did you know that?
Yeah, no. He's just going to, like, get rid of the letter because it seemed so out of character, you know, I'm going to bring him down, down, down.
Yeah.
Like, but it was so melodramatic to me that it was just like, no, he's just...
Do you remember an earlier scene, we don't see it, but he tells us about it, where he had a business rival in his power, and he could have destroyed the business rival. And he did. He was too, what?
He was too noble for that.
Too noble, too magnanimous. Mm-hmm. He's not that type. So you knew ahead of time, or you're sort of prepared for this. Anybody else want to jump in here? Can we get a debate in any way going? Should he have used the letter?
Any sort of, you know, you set up, there's a scene in which he meets the Marquise and her son, I never remember the title.
Yeah.
In the park, in which he says, couldn't you have met me without my mother? And all the way to them as well, I thought. And there were a couple of scenes in which there seemed to be a sort of understanding between the two men, between Newman and the son, the Belgrade.
The young Marquise.
Yeah, the young Marquise, in which each recognized the talents of the other, or the ingrained nobleness of the other.
Well, he feels that way more about the mother, I think, doesn't he? He says to the title's here hard, Marquise is the feminine, I guess, Marquise is the plural. And he says to the Marquise, I would have been your greatest admirer. In fact, he sees some kinship, I think, between himself and her. That they are, you know, in the way they're both sort of daring, bold. The son is kind of a factotum, isn't he? Kind of a wimp. His mother's always saying, do something. He said, what? He's not a great figure in the novel. But Newman does see a kind of... You wonder if the Marquise had, if the roles were reversed and she had a letter she could use on Newman. Not too much question. She didn't stuck it in and twist it, is there? She's a pretty ruthless figure. I mean, anybody would kill her husband over a who shall I daughter marry? And if they disagree, she poisons him. I think in some way James is meaning for us to see her as this great, as the French would say, formidable, you know, this imposing sort of figure. And Newman really admires her. But is it that that keeps him from playing his trump card?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I thought that in a way I kind of hoped that he would tell everybody about it, just because they were so mean that you kind of didn't want them to get away with it.
That they deserved it.
Yeah.
Any of you feel that way? Maybe I should have put it in this way. If you'd been in Newman's place, what would you have done with him? Not much juice in this question. Is the story too stacked so that there's not really much doubt of what Newman's going to do? And is that indeed not in some way James's point? To take revenge would have lowered Newman's character to their level? Yeah.
I think that throughout the novel, Newman was so built up to be this noble and great person, and just in order to have a shot at even
that's right. Her, he has that, to, yeah.
That at the end of the novel, he had to burn the letter in order, because that was in his character. If he wouldn't have burned it, it would have been totally out of his character and wouldn't represent the first half of the novel at all.
Okay. That he is so good, and you know, this is what Mrs. Tristram says to him right at the end. The Bellegardes never really feared you very much, and that's the reason why.
That's what I think is so interesting, because how I read the end was that after, you know, Mrs. Tristram says, you know, you're a great person and we're never scared of beating. He looks back and he wishes, you know, he wishes he weren't that way or something. You know, you kind of
yeah. That ending is very interesting, isn't it? It's caused a lot of critical ink to be spilled. What does that mean? That very last sentence where she says, "They bluffed you. They knew they could bluff you. They counted on your good nature. You see, so that they really, you know, it's like a poker game. They knew they could." And so the last sentence is he sort of looks back to see the letter, to see if it was all burned. Does that indicate then that he wishes he hadn't been so gullible? That he's having second thoughts? If he had the letter back now, would he do something? Or is it just, maybe she's right, the letter's gone. That's, you know, you can interpret, James loves these sort of ambiguous endings. You know, that don't wrap everything up for you quite as concisely and neatly as you might have desired. So they're very different ways of reading that very ending. But clearly, I think what James was wanting to do was to make Newman superior to the Bellegardes. There is a passage in Shakespeare's The Tempest that I wanted to read you. You probably don't know the story, and I'm not going to try to fill you in much on it. But the central character, Prospero, is a man who's learned magic and has in his power a group of people who did him a terrible wrong, much more than the Bellegardes did to Christopher Newman. They meant to kill him, in fact. And now they're in his power. And he can do with them what he will. And his servant of the air, Ariel, says, "Your charm so strongly works on him that if you beheld them, your affection would become tender." And Prospero says, "Do you think so, spirit?" And Ariel says, this is such great Shakespeare, "Mine would, sir, were I human." And Prospero says, "And mine shall. Though with their high wrongs I am struck to the quick, yet with my nobler reason gainst my fury do I take part. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance." That's the great line. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. So in a sense, he's saying paying people back in kind for what they did you is never as noble, never even as reasonable, he says, as acting virtuously, kindly, forgivingly. It's a wonderful sentiment. I don't buy it for a moment. I'm the revenge type.
I also think that part of it is at the end of the story, he's tired. You know, he's endured so much action and so much injustice that at the end he only has himself and his character to draw upon in his past. And he realizes, I think, that to act to disgrace the Belgarde's name would also be to hurt those that he's come to love most.
Well, but Valentine's dead, and Claire would never know about it. She's not.
All that they had, protecting them. Claire and Valentine, that's the only thing. He had everything. You know, he had money, he has his personal honor, he has all of that. He just doesn't have the noble title. And especially for those two, and Valentine being dead, his name, his family name, is pretty much all he had. He didn't have wealth or a career for himself.
But that would be, do you see that then as having a kind of ulterior motive? I mean, that he does have a kind of, what would you say, reason other than just the goodness of the action itself to motivate him. Does my question make sense to you?
Not so much.
I mean, are you seeing that there's still a certain amount of calculation in what Newman is doing, where he says, well, if I did that, I would hurt these people or I would hurt myself in this way, rather than it just being this completely generous, disinterested, which I hope you know doesn't mean uninterested, action on his part.
And I think a big part of it is calculated, just like in the story, even his affections for Claire, part of it was calculated. Part of it was genuine, I think, you know, that he actually
That's
felt
right.
special around her, but part of it was his own motivation, his knowing that, you know, they had that, she had that thing to
yeah,
offer.
That's right.
To him. And yeah. So, I think the same way in the end, part of it's virtue, part of it's genuine, and part of it's his knowing that that would hurt them.
Okay.
There's nothing they can do to defend
that. Let's look for just a minute at the scene where he actually decides that he's not going to take the revenge, but a little before he runs away. He's gone back to Paris after being in America for a while. He, you know, is wandering around. He goes into Notre Dame. This passage always amuses me greatly. I don't know if you have ever been to Paris. Have you ever tried to get into Notre Dame Cathedral these days? It's like being in a New York subway at rush hour. I mean, you're just like, and here he's all alone. He can sit down and he can think and contemplate this sort of thing. I thought, lots of luck trying that these days. But here he is in Notre Dame at the top of page 446. He leaned his head for a long time on the chair in front of him. When he took it up, he felt that he was himself again. Somewhere in his mind, a tight knot seemed to have loosened. He thought of the Belgardes. He had almost forgotten them. He remembered them as a people he had meant to do something to. He gave a groan as he remembered what he had meant to do. He was annoyed at having meant to do it. The bottom suddenly had fallen out of his revenge. Whether it was Christian charity or unregenerate good nature, what it was in the background of his soul, I don't pretend to say. But Newman's last thought was that, of course, he would let the Belgardes go. If he had spoken it aloud, he would have said that he did not want to hurt them. He was ashamed of having wanted to hurt them. They had hurt him. But such things were not really his game. So, James is just wanting, in a sense, to present Newman as too noble to do anything vindictive or vengeful. So, in the novel, there's been a kind of complete reversal of values. Who is now the real nobleman? What Benjamin Franklin would call nature's nobleman. And it's clearly Newman. And what are the aristocrats except hypocrites, farceurs, you know, or posers, phonies, who have no real nobility for all of their blue blood, for all of their title. There's no real nobility in their behavior at all. This is the Americans. So that rather than the novel in any way being a condescension on the part of Europe to the American. The tables are turned. It's a kind of condescension on the part of the American for the Europeans, which is not too surprising, we think, in an American writer. Except that James, in some ways, was so much more attuned to Europe and its values than he was to America and its, that it's in a way surprising, of all writers, for James to be the one to, in a sense, celebrate, elevate, canonize this American, not only an American businessman. That type, so, not exactly reviled, but mocked. And the butt of so much criticism. To make this figure then in some way the noblest figure in the book is in many ways a very striking reversal, I think, of expectation.
I think there was some nobility in when he goes to the older lady, Madame de
Octreville, the Duchess.
Right, and the way she behaves, where she doesn't allude to any of the bad things that have happened to Newman, I think she behaves very nobly in that scene.
Well, he thinks she's just simply being, super subtle, rather cunning. Let me take this up with you just for a second. This is in the stage where he still wants to expose the Bellegarde. He's got that letter in his pocket, and he's going around. This is the beginning, he thinks, of showing them up for what they are. And the first person that he goes to is the old Duchess, supposedly the most venerated figure in aristocratic France. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't show her the letter. Is it because the nobility of her character dissuades him? His own view of this is what, do you recall? She would have believed it. He didn't doubt that she would have believed him. But she would, in a sense, have closed ranks with the Bellegardes. She might even later, who knows, this is pure speculation, she might even later have in some way criticized them. But not to him, not publicly. Not to an outsider. So that he saw suddenly that he's dealing with people who, even if he divulged this information, they might indeed think much less of the Bellegardes, but it would always be contained within those private walls of the Faubourg Saint-Germain. Does that make sense? And he realized in a way, I don't know how this affects our idea of his nobleness. And he realizes, in a way, what's he going to do with these letters if not burn them? Was there no National Enquirer in Paris then? No hard copy? No gossip columnists? Couldn't you do something with this letter? It's partly, it seems as if Newman doesn't have an avenue for his... Although I don't think that's what James wanted us to conclude. That he didn't expose him because he simply had no means to do it. I don't think James wanted us to view it in those terms, but rather to see it as this act of great magnanimity. There's another problem with this that I wanted to raise with you, although in a way it's an illegitimate consideration. I've always thought that Newman did the wrong thing by burning the letters. Because I thought he owed something to the old Marquis. The old Marquis gave the letter to Mrs. Bread and said, on page 414, he put it into her hands, she said, he put it into her hands with a solemn injunction that she was to make it public. Well, she didn't. She sat on it all these years because she didn't know what to do with it. She gives it to Newman and tells him that what the Marquis wanted was for this to be made public. We worry about the good name of the Bellegardes. He didn't worry about the good name of the Bellegardes. He said, expose my wife for the murderess that she is. And I think that's what he should have done. I think he should have taken the letter to the police, turned it over to them and said, do with it whatever you want to, but this woman, or her husband at least, thinks this woman murdered him. Here's the evidence. He has, the whole situation is set up as if it's only a question of his revenge. Can Newman use the letter to get his revenge? Nobody ever asked the question, what about the justice to the Marquis?
Mm-hmm. I feel like not only that, but I think Valentine wanted him to expose them too, because he knew.
Yeah, why would he tell him otherwise?
Yeah, and by not doing it, like, he kind of destroyed Mrs. Brent's and Valentine's and the old Marquis, not just the old Marquis. And if he didn't want to do it himself, he should have just told, like, Mrs. Tristram, and the whole world would have found out.
Yeah, that's true. She'd have spent like... No, I mean, I would see this not as a moral matter, but as a legal matter. Now, he says to Mrs. Brent later that she's beyond the reach of the law. But how does he know?
That's what I was going to say. I thought the book had like kind of a decent discussion about how she would never be convicted.
And maybe she wouldn't. But was it Newman's judgment to make? In other words, isn't he burning evidence of a crime purely for his own moral self-satisfaction? As I say, I think this is an illegitimate consideration I've injected here, because James doesn't make that really part of the calculus of the novel. But still, when I was reading the novel, I thought, hey, wait a minute, you know, he owes something to this dead man who wrote this letter, you know, this dying letter, almost with his life's blood, saying, I want this crime to be known. You know, I don't want to just die, with no consequences. Take this letter, give it to the police. Newman has this letter in his possession. He looks at it and says, oh, I would feel bad if I used this letter. You see, my moral character would suffer if I were to, in any way, be seen as getting rid of it. I think, screw that. Give the police the letter. That should be there.
There's that conversation about slinging mud, which I thought was really interesting. And there really is no way, I mean, it's still true today, there's no way to sling mud without getting your hands dirty. And so,
well,
I mean,
but going
to the police
wouldn't be slinging mud, would it? Well, all I can say is if I were in Newman's place, I'd have gone to the police and said, here's a letter. This crime is committed, we believe. Do with it what you will. Maybe they'll do nothing, but you've done what you could to see that no one ever said, should justice be done in this case? But James doesn't, you know, that's outside the room. James doesn't even include that as a, well, I think he briefly alludes to it. But that would so deflect from the ideology that he's trying to develop. And I do think that there's a kind of argument, let's not say ideology, argument, kind of argument that he's wanting to develop in this novel would have simply have been sidetracked or deflected by that kind of consideration. He is wanting to make this novel. He says the light is always on Christopher Newman. So he's always wanting to know what in Newman's character would his disposition of this letter reveal. And what he's wanting to do is give us the noblest gesture on Newman's part to show his superiority to this world that condescends to him, that they are, in fact, morally compromised, and he's the one who emerges. Sadly, perhaps even tragically, but nevertheless ennobled by the events of the story. And if we look at it then in terms of national characters, in a way, the American triumphs over the French, morally. The American values, insofar as Newman embodies them, triumphs over the aristocratic values, which includes sort of this hypocrisy and double dealing, subterfuge of the world of the Belgrades. And that's why I think that really his visit to the Duchess is a kind of reinforcement that he sees that they would not ever condemn openly for all the world to see one of their own. They wouldn't wash their dirty linen in public. So they'd rather, in some way, close ranks around a murderess than they would in any way to have the truth come out. So that it's not simply the Bellegardes. I think that scene is put there, in my opinion, in some way to show the kind of corruptness sort of moral, what would you say, laxity of their whole class, which after all, going back to James Joyce, pretends to a kind of moral superiority. What he's wanting to show is that's complete counterfeit. Does this make sense to you? Mm-hmm.
I just actually had a quick question about that scene with the Duchess. I'm not trying to find a page number, so I'm going to keep talking as I look for it. But, like, it seems like in that scene, the point of view changes, like, really quick, like, to her point of view when she says she's going to act charming and then, like, she won't, like, speak to him again. Is it, like... Is that just her imagination, or is that like
no,
the time it really just?
No, his feeling is she receives him, but he doesn't really matter to her, and she's in a way now ready to brush him off. You know, he's had his few minutes with her, and she's got other things to do, and he. That he sees that he doesn't really count to them, particularly now that he's not going to marry Claire. He was kind of getting an entree into their world. Now, this is my interpretation of it. He, to some degree, he mattered at the ball when he was being introduced to all these important people because he was about to marry Claire. Even then, they're kind of looking at him like he's this dancing bear. And they have all these stories about him. They said, is it true that you're the Duke of California and you give land away to people who agree not to smoke cigars? And then there are all these sorts of crazy legends about it. Remember him when you read Gatsby. There's an awful lot of Christopher Newman in Gatsby. The same love of opulence and display and wanting to marry a woman who's in excess. I've always thought that probably Fitzgerald had read The American. It certainly draw, if he didn't draw from it, they certainly are parallel characters. But despite their interest in him, at the ball, he's still an alien. He's still this curiosity. And so when he comes to visit the Duchess again, you know, she receives him, she sees him, she's charming to him in her way, but he realizes, and this is what he realizes, that in her radar screen, he doesn't really register. He doesn't matter.
Yeah, I understood that, but what I was just, it was more like a stylistic question because I found it. It's like at the very bottom of page 422.
422?
Like, yeah. And like James writes, he had come, so reason the Duchess. And then like he puts a dash. And like, does it change to her point of view for like a sentence? Like, having knew why he had come after what happened?
Well, I think that's you're right. That is an interesting stylistic device because. He's going to give us the motive, and then he kind of indicates Newman wasn't quite sure why he did it. Is that that he had come, so reason the Duchess, heaven knows why he had come after what had happened. And for I see you, that this may, you're right, I'm sorry, I was misreading it. But this is the Duchess's mind, not his.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, was it him or her?
Therefore, she would be charming, but she would never see him again. Okay, yeah, you're right. For a minute at least, we are in the Duchess's mind. I'll see him. I'll see what he wants. I'll be charming to him, but he's not. He doesn't matter to me. I'm always wondering if he pulled out the letter and read it. What would have been a reaction? I always wanted to rewrite people's books for them. Terrible fault. But when he tries to broach anything, she always has ways of deflecting it. But then as the Duchess went on relating a mode which her mother had snubbed the great Napoleon, it occurred to Newman that her evasion of a chapter of French history was more interesting to himself, might possibly be the result of extreme consideration for his feelings. Perhaps it was delicacy on the Duchess' part, not policy. See, the affair's been, the engagement's been broken off. What's she to say to him? And so what he's trying to convey, I guess, is something like the sense that the Duchess was trying to talk to him without really saying anything. Do you know those kind of conversations? Where you talk to people and what you're really
concerned with doesn't get discussed. Is that what's going on here? And he realizes sort of exercising that Gallic finesse, you know, where you just get shown out of the room and you realize, I never got to say what I came to, or I never said what I meant to say. Is that the situation?
I guess, as interesting as the scene is in itself, and it is a very interesting thing, it's there probably to show that Newman realizes to some degree the complicity of that whole class in this kind of corruption. Is that right? I mean, what good would it have done to tell the Duchess? What would she have done with that information? Would she immediately start calling all of her friends and say, we can never have the Bellegardes to dinner again, they're murderesses? And he says that he leaves. Why did I come here? What did I think I was going to achieve? What did I expect? And in a sense, there really was not much. I don't know about quite the word I'm searching for. Potential, I suppose. Of getting any satisfaction from telling the Duchess. Was he going to feel better if he could somehow besmirch the Bellegardes? Would he feel better? And he kind of comes away, I guess. Not really. So already you may have a kind of foreshadowing of his later complete burning of the letters. What am I going to do with these letters? Nothing. What can I do that would matter? Nothing. Why did I even think about it? I'm embarrassed. Did I ever even consider that? Although I'm a little bit bothered by the fact that James can't quite decide whether it's a purely noble, generous decision on Newman's part, or if it's just a practical consideration. There's nothing to do with the letters. You know, there's no way to get the kind of revenge I want. And I don't think James means to do the latter. I think he very much means to do the former, which is to make Newman's gesture seem all the more noble, generous, forgiving. The rarer action is in virtue than in vengeance. That's what he wants to concentrate on. But he does complicate it a little bit by showing in some of these other scenes that practically, how would he get it?
Could he have also been a context? Because it seems like for the majority of the novel, Newman's built up, you know, like his character's built up, and, you know, he's so persistent and so strong and so invincible that maybe at the end he's presenting a contrast. Like, I remember reading at 438, you know, he's talking about he had no desire to make acquaintances, and, you know, he thought a great deal of Madame de Saintré. He lived over and over again the happiest hours he had known. He starts to think, he asks himself in his quieter hours whether perhaps after all he was more commercial than was pleasant. I think that he's, like in retrospect, I think he's thinking about a lot of things that he may not have had to think about before. Like in his solitude and his...
Yes,
yeah. I still feel that he's, to a certain extent, tired or a little bit down.
Oh, he is, yeah.
You know,
yeah, he is.
I don't think it's like a, you know, carrying the flag up to the mountain.
I see your point, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. In fact, this is a very Jamesian denouement, too, in this sense, that Newman, who's always been a practical go-getter, a doer, you know, if there's a problem, you grab it and you solve it. This is what he's always saying to Valentine. You've got to take hold of life. You've got to grab it and do things and make things happen. You don't just, you know, let things happen to you. So you can see that Newman had always been that kind of driving, aggressive sort of figure. You know, if there's a problem in the world, you slap it around and get it into shape and take charge. And now, for the first time, he realizes, perhaps, this is going to sound a little pretentious, sort of the tragic dimension of life, that there are things you can't control. There are things that lie beyond your ability to change. And he's a different man at the end. I think he is noble, you know, and certainly James is wanting to say, if you're contrasting these two societies, these two characters, surely we would agree, I think, the American emerges as the better, the nobler, you know, the victory goes in that, in the moral sense, clearly to the American. But at the same time, that sort of American belief that every problem has a solution, the can-do attitude, what's the CB's motto? Can-do. That's shown to be an illusion. And that in a way, Newman has met the complexity of the old world, all the subtlety and intricacy. And to a degree, he's been defeated by that. In that sense, that the world is a much more complex, and confining. You know, one of the interesting questions they always said, where would he and Claire have gone to live if they'd gotten married? Where would they belong? And he sort of says to her, we have the whole world to choose from. You know, we could go anywhere, we could do anything. That notion that you've got all sorts of possibilities. And Claire is sort of, is everything really possible? Yeah. To her European sensibility, his American optimism seems to be really over generous.
Well, perhaps also Newman's aggressiveness always came from his self-interest. He always had something to gain by his solving problems, and in this case, he really has nothing left to gain from the situation.
That's right.
He's not acting for the higher noble cause of exposing French aristocracy, but rather it's just, you know, he wanted to find a wife. Well, he can't do that now. He wanted to learn of the higher, you know, learn about this higher society, and he doesn't like what he sees. So there's really no motivation for him to continue his action.
That's true, but we may be saying in a way the same thing in sort of different way. When he has the letter, first he wants to use it. You know, I've got this letter. He has a sort of aggressive attitude. I've got to do something with it. So first he thinks he can get Claire back. That's his original plan. He thinks he can, in a sense, sort of leverage Claire out of the Bellegarde's grip with this letter. He finds out she's at the convent. That's over. So there's no practical use in that. He's still got the idea, okay, you know, maybe I can't get her back, but I certainly can, in some way, pay them back for what they did to me. So that's his next line. He starts to do that. But then he realizes this thing, so what? So that in one way, he's left with that sense of no more possibilities. There's nothing to do. If you're a doer all your life, you know, and suddenly you're faced with a situation where there's nothing for you to do, there's nothing you can do, it must be a really maturing sort of insight, and in some ways a very depressing one. You know? Are there things in the world I can't change? I have to face this, and there's nothing I can do about it. And so in one way, I think James would say that Newman has learned that lesson. And I don't mean to make this altogether nationalistic. I think he's saying in some way it's the naive American who thinks everything is possible, coming into this contact with Europeans who are much more aware of or accepting of the limitations of life. You know, again, going back to Valentine is saying to him, you're so lucky. You've got the whole world. You can go out and do anything. And he says, so could you. Valentine says, no, you don't understand. I have a position in life that in a way traps me or limits me. There are all sorts of things I can't do. There are many things. Most things I can't do. And then they say, come to America with me. If we go to America, you have all these possibilities. I'll put you in a bank. You can make some money. Valentine's, that sounds good. But on the other hand, the reality of his situation is that he's much more confined, much more limited. And so, again, to kind of reduce this to nationalistic attitudes. The Americans are more optimistic. They see everything as possible. And, you know,
why not? Let's try it. You know, if you haven't tried it, how do you know you can't do it? So that you know, sort of pushing can-do attitude. On the other hand, we think of the European attitude as being much more, we've lived longer, we've seen more, we know what the limitations are, we accept them. And so in a way, you could say that Newman is almost Europeanized by his experience into the limits, the limitations of life, and sort of the tragic dimensions of life. But as is often the case, I don't want to say the garden is a tragedy, that's too grandiose, but that in a way, as in tragedies, out of the suffering, the hero learns something. And so he learns a kind of chastened nobility, his original good nature and generosity is in some sense refined by the experience that he has in Europe. So he's a sadder but wiser man at the end. Would we agree on that? But I don't mean to overstress this point, but I just wanted to say what's in some ways so surprising is that if there is some battle going on, some contest going on between what it is the Bellegardes represent and what it is that Newman represents, there's no question. Whatever it is that Newman represents emerges from this novel as the morally superior element. If it's a clash of class and money, we often think Newman only represents money and the Bellegardes class in the sense of status. And so, but there is a sense in which James is kind of subverting those categories, and that the real nobleman of this novel is clearly, I think. Well, what else do we want to say about the novel? Jane, do you have a comment or question?
I'm for the novel and the novel. I mean, there's still a comment that, and Mrs. Tristram's character I find so interesting too.
Yes.
Because she travels in two worlds like James does.
She does.
And, you know, I don't know what her underhanded motives are necessarily for getting him started on this journey to begin with. And they're obviously not single-minded necessarily on her part.
And they talk about that right at the end, where he says to her, why did you ever start this in the first place? Was it just curiosity on your part? And she says, what? Do you remember this? Very, very near the end. It's an interesting passage. 428. He says to her, was it from curiosity that you urged me to try and marry? A little, said Mrs. Tristram, growing still more audacious. Newman gave her the one angry look he had been destined ever to give her, turned away and took up his hat. She watched him for a moment, and then she said, that sounds very cruel, but it is less so than it sounds. Curiosity has a share in almost everything I do. I wanted very much to see, first, whether such a marriage could actually take place, and second, what would happen if it should take place. So you didn't believe, said Newman resentfully. Yes, I believed that it would take place and that you would be happy. Otherwise, I should have been, among my speculations, a very heartless creature. But, she continued, laying her hand upon Newman's arm and hazarding a grave smile, it was the highest flight ever taken by a tolerably bold imagination. I thought you could pull it off, but it was the most audacious and the most daring idea I ever had. But I thought you could.
Mm-hmm. It kind of seemed like she did it for like her own like entertainment.
Yeah.
Like just to like sit back and watch the soap opera unfold and what's going to happen. So.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's what I think she means by curiosity. I just wanted to see what would happen.
Okay, that's a good
one. Yeah. James's fiction is full of people like this. I think the greatest of all James novels, although obviously did, is Portrait of a Lady. And in it, a young man, Ralph Touchett, manages for his cousin, Isabel Archer, to inherit a lot of money, a great deal of money, because he said he wanted to see what would happen to her in the world if she had wings to fly anywhere. This money's going to free her, he thinks. Give her all this money. I just want to see what would happen to her.
Do you remember that old show, The Millionaire, not Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? It used to be the guy would go around and give people $1 million. Someone was short, not going to go to Jane, what, Tipton Thomas, something, Jane. No, anyway. And because he just wanted to see, what would this person do? If you suddenly had $1 million, what would this person do? And of course, a lot of times the stories are terrible. You know, awful things would happen. But they were just satisfying their curiosity. So Ralph Touchett in Portrait of a Lady just wants to see, what will happen to my cousin if she's suddenly made extremely wealthy? And pretty awful things happen to her. And to some degree, that's what's true of Mrs. Tristram here. I just want to see. You remember when he goes to her and tells her about the party he's planning, she says, it's, what's her first word? Odious. It's delicious. It's a terrible party to give. I love it. So you know her kind of character, don't you? She just likes to see, in a way, she likes to cause trouble, or, you know, just throw the golden apple in the midst of all the people and see how they're going to find it. So yeah, I think that she's a fascinating character as a kind of observer. And if you want to make it psychological, you could say she's bored, you know, her husband's a dimwit, she has nothing else to do, so why not just arrange people's lives, meddle a little, see if I can't cause some excitement. James has, as I say, this often catalyst sort of character who loves it. Let's see what will happen if. Jean, did you?
I don't know. I was just trying to. I wish I could have found the spot then. I mean, I sort of want to discount her now, where she talks about how aristocratic it was for the Belgrades to, you know, get rid of him in spite of the money that they got it.
No, she said, it was, they gave you up for an ideal, she says. And that really, she said, that really was aristocratic. That they would sacrifice all this money for, you know, for a principle. And that, you know, if you believe that, then you would say, yeah, they really, is that, they have in effect lived up to their principle. They were about to sell out. But at the last moment, the Marquis says, I could not reconcile myself to a commercial person. We tried to swallow it, and we just couldn't. We gagged. And so that in some way, you could say she was really acting out of principle. On the other hand, when Lord Deepmere comes to the ball that night, isn't she trying to get him to court Claire right under her fiancé's nose? You know, the very night that their engagement is being announced, the mother's over there saying to somebody else, I take it that's what they're talking about. And Lord Deepmere has no great interest in Claire, but he's filthy rich. And so the mother is the one who's behind the scenes trying to sabotage this engagement and maybe get Lord Deepmere to.
Well, wasn't, you know, there was a comment made that she, maybe she, did she do this? Well, he was giving it away, but wasn't the final straw where she had to escort him around to meet her friends anyway? I mean, she was already at that point.
Yeah. At the end
of her. Without Deepmere, whatever, I couldn't remember under factoid either. Yeah. I mean, she was going to give him up. I mean, they were going
to. Well, that night, he kind of knows he's doing this too. Newman kind of, you know, knows that he's pushing this to the limit. He says, "Take my arm and let's walk," you know, so that they kind of do a. It's like a victory lap for him. You see, this is the. He says this is the greatest night of his life. He's now reached the pinnacle. Poor boy, lived on the streets, made his money for himself, climbed the ladder. To him now, if what he's after is status, this is it. You see, all of these French aristocrats gathered together. He's nabbed the daughter, you know, he's got the prize. And now he makes the mother kind of, who's really in some way the one he's defeated. If you see this, it's a contest. You know, he's bought from them. His money has trumped their status.
And that this kind of victory lap around the room with the old marquise on his arm is his, he's showing off. And there's a scene that is kind of a little far-fetched, but there's a scene in Agamemnon where the wife is coming to destroy her husband, persuades him to walk on the purple carpet that's sort of reserved for the gods, you know. And it's that moment where his hubris, pride in himself is pushed to the extreme. And so this scene has been compared to something like that, that Newman just pushes it so far, and that perhaps it's at that moment where the Marquise realizes, as much as we'd like to get our hands on all that money, we can't swallow it. So that it's not the next day, but a few days after he comes, and that's when she says, I've told my daughter she must break off her engagement. And I love that line. I cannot reconcile myself to a commercial person. You know, somebody used to make wash tubs. So that you can see, okay, they are in a way living up to their aristocratic ideals. Although it is undermined a little bit if you think she's got Lord Deepmere waiting in the wings. If she could dump this guy and still marry her daughter. But there's no very clear indication that Lord Deepmere has any interest in Claire. And indeed, it's very interesting, I think, that we see him again at the end. This is the answer to the question I asked you today. Did you all get it? With Naomi Nioche, who's this courtesan now. He's obviously taken her up. She's there as his, what would you say these days, squeeze. And her father always said, so, you know, if my daughter dishonors our name, if she becomes a fallen woman, someday I'll shoot her. And Newman says, I kept looking at the newspapers, but I never saw any newspapers that he shot her. So, but I think the reason for including that scene at the end is to show that Lord Deepmere, whose cousin, in a sense, whose death she's responsible for, has nevertheless taken up with her. He's forgotten. That was then, this is now. And she's a real good lay. And so they're, you know, they're this kind of corruption, they're keeping company at that stage. Is again, I think, showing something of the selling out that the aristocrats are willing to do for Deepmere to have taken as his mistress this woman who was implicated in his cousin's death, and he's embarrassed by it. He kind of, you know, he tries to explain it away to Newman, but the very fact that he's embarrassed by it shows that he's having to rationalize a choice that's questionable. To put it right. Well, anything else about the America that we want to touch on? Well, let me shift gears for a few minutes then to prep you for what we'll do next week. If James was a little bit too rarefied for you, did I ever quote to you that wonderful line of Clover Hooper's? Clover Hooper was a very witty woman married to Henry Adams, who's one of the great American intellectuals. And she knew all the famous people of her day. And she had one of the best comments about Henry James and his novel. She said, it's not that Henry bit off more than he could chew, but that he chewed more than he bit off. And a lot of readers sort of feel that way. James does go on, and it gets more elaborate the older he got. H.G. Wells once did a parody of James where he imagines this great cathedral with stained glass windows and the organ playing and this huge edifice, and you get toward the altar, and there on the altar you see a dead cat, a bit of string. All of this whole elaborate edifice is built up for this kind of, you know, very minor little payoff. And so there are readers who felt that way about James's, you know, over elaborateness and over sophistication, too many nuances and this sort of thing. And the American, by contrast, is quite, for James, quite a simple novel, an early, straightforward sort of novel compared to
quite a bit later. But in any case, if you've had enough James to satiate you for a while, you'll see Jack London, who we'll look at next, is a very, very different kind of writer. James, as I suggested to you, was from the old money Cambridge Newport set, who spent most of his life in Europe anyway. But insofar he is an American, was very much part of the Eastern Seaboard Eurocentric class. Jack London was the illegitimate child of a fortune teller and an itinerant spiritualist. His mother, when she was 6 months pregnant, married a different man who was named London, also John London. And so that Jack had this man's name all of his life. But he found early in his 20s that the man he had thought was his father really wasn't. And he, as people in that situation often do, was looking for his real father, who was really just a kind of con artist, a charlatan. So, they were very poor his whole life, or in his childhood, his parents were very poor, living sort of hand to mouth. And London belonged not so much to the working class as to what Marx would call the lumpen proletariat, the class below the working class, the sort of unemployed, semi-criminal class. At a very early age, Jack London was an oyster pirate, which meant that he used to go around at night stealing the catches from other men's boats. Oyster fishermen who'd gone out and caught their catch would dock overnight, and London and his compatriots would rob them of their catch. And that was, I guess, his earliest job, was to be a thief. He was a hobo, joined something called Cox's Army that was going to march on Washington, except he and some of the other guys went ahead of it and claimed they were gathering up supplies for them and would run off with the food they had. Spent some time in jail in Niagara Falls, New York, for vagrancy. So that he had, you know, here was Henry James going to Harvard and spending his days in the Louvre. Here's Jack London hoboing it, spending his time in the Niagara Falls jail. He went to Alaska in the gold rush, prospected for gold. All of this before he was 21. London died when he was 41, having written 50 books. That always astounds me. Want to blot it out. That old saying, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, was pretty much the credo that London lived by. The novel, then, that we'll read of London's, Martin Eden, is highly autobiographical, not totally so. This whole question of autobiographical novels is a very tangled, tortured one. But in its broad outlines, the story of Martin Eden and the story of Jack London, up to a certain point, run remarkably parallel. So that what we're going to get, in some ways for the first time, is the Horatio Alger story told from the inside. Clearly, Horatio Alger's telling us the story of Ragged Dick is really told by an adult who is trying to imagine what it was like being the street kid, but in some ways really giving Dick the perspective and the motives of an adult. He very quick, you know, almost overnight, Dick suddenly is converted to watch cleaning himself up,
going straight, working hard, banking his money. Those are not the 14-year-old attitudes. Did you agree with me on that? And then, in a sense, very much Alger makes Dick a kind of premature adult so that he can teach thrift and hard work and providence. That sort of thing. Then when Henry James takes the same kind of character, he passes over it so quickly. There are those few pages in which we have Newman's childhood and his making himself a millionaire. But James really had no knowledge of that, no first-hand knowledge of that. And so he gets it, you know, over with in very short order and just sort of decrees it. That's going to be the given of the story. Here we have the self-made millionaire. Where do we see him? We see him sitting in the Louvre looking at art. That's where the story opens. And everything before that is very, very lightly sketched. Because James had no idea at all what it was like to have been a poor kid, you know, living hand to mouth, sleeping in a box on the street. London did. London is going to write now from the perspective of someone who's been down and out, what he called in the abyss. He decided, in fact, one day when he was, I think when he was sitting in jail, two things can happen to me. What can happen to me is what happened to all the people around me. They're losers. They're in this pit, the abyss. They're never going to climb out. They're going to be victims all their life. I can accept that. Or, he says, I can find some way out of this, and I don't want it to be manual labor. That's no way out. It has to be intellectual labor. So London just sort of said to himself one day, I'm bright. I can think my way out of the abyss. And indeed he does. So what we're going to... Martin Eden is then that very personalized account of this climb out of the abyss, off living in the streets to... you'll see to what. There's some things in Martin Eden that will seem improbable, as there were in Ragged Dick. The only difference is they'd happened to London. So that when the cards start falling in Martin Eden's direction, or in his favor, that's almost exactly what happened to London. So from being this poor, obscure, nobody, to almost overnight fame and fortune, was exactly what had happened to Jack Knuckle. So there are things I'll try to fill in for you that I think help in comparing the life and the work. Since I haven't given you a writing assignment for to take up with you today, you can assume then that you're going to have one in class next time. And if you want a hint, I'm about to give you one. Think laundry. That's my name. Think laundry. I think you'll see that. Okay.
Very good, very good.